Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to American Italian Radio, where we explore the life of American Italian entertainers, storytellers, and artisans. There are 100 million Italophiles, people who like all things Italian, and our program is designed to share the American Italian heritage with all of you. We invite our guests to discuss their lives, their careers, and how their American Italian heritage has influenced them, and to tell us about their new projects. And now, let's join our hosts, Sal LaFerry and Don Mazzella.
Well, hello, and welcome to the American Italian Radio Channel on Blog Talk Radio. You're listening to the Air Radio, which is sponsored by Protective Countermeasures and by the Small Business Digest. I'm Sal LaFerry, and I'm here with my co-host of Air Radio, Don Mazzella.
Good to be here.
As this is our initial broadcast, our inaugural broadcast, I should say, I would like to introduce the purpose of the show to you. Don and I believe that what this country needs to remember is that we are Americans first, and that our heritage formed us and shaped us into who we are today. We should never lose the pride in being American, but also we should not forget the customs, traditions, and memories of life as an American Italian. You know, a funny thing happened in the research that went into putting this show together. Don and I learned that there are over 100 million Americans, now that's nearly one-third of the country, who are either American-Italian by heritage or have identified themselves as Italophiles. So now you're going to ask yourself, just what is an Italophile? An Italophile is someone who enjoys all things Italian, from the food to the wine to the cooking to the clothing, all the accessories, everything that goes with the Italian culture. What we hope to bring to you each week on the Air Network is the best in American Italian talk radio. Our guests are going to be leaders in each of their respective fields, talking about where they are today, where they came from, but more importantly, we're going to spend a little time taking a stroll down memory lane, reminiscing about the days growing up Italian, sharing those funny and sometimes not so funny experiences. You know, things like the Sunday meals, the weddings, the funerals. And, of course, we can't forget that one really unique person in all of our lives, whether it's an aunt or an uncle, a grandfather, a grandmother, we all have one in our family. You know, it's a funny thing. As I look at our heritage and traditions, I notice something pretty remarkable, or maybe should I say pretty unremarkable. Our culture does not try hard enough to perpetuate itself. If you think about it, Jewish children have to go to Jewish school. Greek children have to go to Greek school. Why is it then that our children aren't forced, and maybe that's an inappropriate term here, but you know, let's use force for the time being, to go to an Italian school? How many traditions are becoming but a faded memory? You know, in the absence of the matriarchal figurehead in our families, the traditions die with them. The grandmother dies and the Sunday dinner goes to pass. Hopefully we will rekindle some of these traditions or thoughts of these traditions in each of you as we run through our shows. I should also point out that our website, which is being developed as we speak, will have some of the best shopping for all goods Italian. We invite you to visit our website and share it among your friends. You can follow and follow the show on Facebook and Twitter. And write questions and comments to Don and I and let us know how we're doing and what you might like to hear on American Italian Radio. Now I'd really like to introduce my good friend and co-host, Mr. Don Mazzella.
Good to be here, Sal.
Don, this has been something we've been looking to do for a while, and I'm really kind of looking forward to the show and being able to not only work with you, but to also cover some of the things that we had talked about. Don, you started out, I mean, obviously you're an American-Italian. Why don't you tell us a little about yourself? Where were you born? Where were you raised?
Well, I was born in Newark, New Jersey, in a neighborhood, the Ironbound, which was, interesting enough, a success. First it was German, then it was Irish, then, in my time it was Italian. Now it is primarily Portuguese, which kind of tells you a little bit about America and how we do things. In my high school, in my grammar school, we were pretty much Italian, a little Irish, a couple of Polish, and one or two what we call Negroes now, we now say blacks. The immortal line of Bill Cosby, he was three different things in his lifetime. But what was really interesting about growing up Italian was the culture. As you mentioned, the Sunday dinner, which I have seen kind of go by the wayside. But interesting enough, someone told me that there's some research out that says that the Sunday dinner is coming back. Whenever I think about Sunday dinner, I think about how much food was on the table and how much we sat around the table and talked. Of course, in those days, the men sat and the women were in the kitchen. Hopefully,
was that like that in your whole neighborhood?
Oh yes. Neighborhood, we had family in the Bronx, and I can remember going to the Bronx, to other parts of New York. I've talked to people in Pittsburgh, in Chicago, Kansas City, which is another strong enclave, and they all kind of remember that, but they also kind of talk about how it's kind of faded away, but there is a great nostalgia for it. You mentioned earlier about weddings. Weddings are elaborate affairs nowadays, but in my time, there were what were called football weddings, immortalized by Pat Cooper in his wonderful monologue. By the way, Pat Cooper, Pasquale Caputo.
Another good Italian-American.
Yes, but interestingly enough, he was forced, in order to get started in comedy, to change the name to Pat Cooper. As he says, it took him some time to realize that he really made his money by talking about his Italian heritage. We hope to get him on sometime. But anyway, to talk about weddings, the football weddings, it was a time when we pulled together. I know there was one, I always talk about this one wedding. A cousin of my mother's was marrying, and God forbid, she was marrying someone who was not Italian, happened to be Polish. And her parents did not like it and would not pay for the wedding. So what we did is my mother ran up the dress, someone else donated the beer, and we all made sandwiches. And how do we make sandwiches? We put them in the ham in one box, gabagool in another, etc. And then went around the tables and said, who wants a ham sandwich? They raised their hand, you threw them a sandwich. Football weddings. Pat Cooper does a better job. But we're talking about a world that people are simply not remembering. But I have a strong sense that the second and third generations are starting to coming back. But Sal, now, where were you born and raised?
I actually was born and raised in East Harlem in New York City, a predominantly Italian area, big immigrant area. My grandparents came from Italy. We went to my grandfather's side of the family came from my father's side came from Calabria, and on my mom's side came from Naples. Big immigrant community developed in Upper East Side in East Harlem, and it was a fun place to grow up.
You had a career in law enforcement. Tell us about it.
I spent 20 years with the New York City Police Department, having to work in multiple assignments from a number of different things, from patrol to investigatory to ultimately to the intelligence division. And I really had a grand old time in doing it. I really enjoyed myself.
How did growing up Italian affect you?
It's funny. I never really expected or felt to be any different growing up. And as a kid, I guess I was sort of fortunate. I never really found a whole lot of bad being Italian. But I can tell you that there were some great memories along the way. And, again, you mentioned the Sunday dinner, and, we talked about in the opening about weddings and funerals and some of the funny and not so funny stories. It's been fun. It's made me who I am today, and I don't think I would have it any other way.
No.
But anyway, what we want to do is we have a guest coming up, and it is it's a very good buddy of mine. After the break, this good friend, the guy who's been a friend for over 20 years, who's in my estimation is just a real American hero, who wound up living the Donnie Brasco life as an undercover agent. His fascinating American-Italian story is coming up next.
Just how dangerous is social networking? Use of websites like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube are all the rage. But what are the downsides of this new technology? The incidents of bullying, stalking, harassment, and inappropriate content are increasing. Just how dangerous is it? What can you do to protect your child and yourself from it? Go to ProtectiveCountermeasures.com for a free hour-long video on the dangers of social networking. That's ProtectiveCountermeasures.com for your free hour-long video.
Well, we're back, and I have a distinct honor of being able to introduce a very good friend of mine, someone who I've known, as I said, for almost 20 years, who I really do consider an American hero. And he's also an American-Italian and an incredibly proud American-Italian. Frank Santasola spent a number of years in law enforcement, and part of that time he spent almost 6 years undercover infiltrating the mob. I got to tell you, it's a real treat, one, to be able to have Frank on our inaugural show, but more importantly, just to be able to present him to the listening audience. Frank, you with us?
Hey, Sal, how are you?
How are
you? You're making my grow. I'm just an average guy.
Hey, Cheech, I understand now in retirement you've taken up golf and teaching cooking. I mean, totally different from what you did, but tell me about the golf game. How are you swinging them?
Well, I've been taking lessons in Vero Beach, Florida, from a guy by the name of Chris Campbell. He's a pro. I couldn't hit the ball to save my life when I started a year ago, and I'm playing like bogey golf now. I'm enjoying it. It's a challenging game because it's a game between the golf ball and yourself.
And you're also doing a little teaching of cooking, so
yeah,
how's that working out down in Vero?
I had a school with – it's sort of slow, but it's a Vero cooking school. It's private cooking lessons. What I thought was that I'd get a group of people together, either husbands, wives, boyfriend, girlfriends, and throw the ball in their court and see what they wanted me to teach them how to cook. And we had beginner classes, intermediate cooking classes, and advanced cooking classes. I'm fortunate enough to get my cooking experience from Chef Emeril Lagasse, who I worked for 10 years.
Frank, where does your love of cooking come from?
Well, my love for cooking, you know, growing up Italian-American, I remember growing up as a kid, waking up to the smell of meatballs and sausages frying in the kitchen, my mom and dad cooking the Sunday gravy. I mean, it's a memory that'll stay with me all my life. It was a wonderful memory, and that's where my love for cooking began.
Frank, interesting. Let's address something right now. You say gravy. I say gravy. Now it's called tomato sauce. Don't you wish everybody would call it gravy?
Yeah, all my life. My mom, that was it. We're having gravy on Sunday. We had gravy on Thursday nights and Sundays. Sunday was the big family day. We'd have aunts and uncles. Maybe 20, 30 people at the house for macaroni, gravy, meatballs, bajoles, salads. It was unbelievable.
What's your favorite recipe, Frank?
Well, my mom's recipe for meatballs and gravy. She had a specific way of doing it, and I wish I could duplicate it, but when you tasted my mother's gravy, it was unique. I guess probably most guys, gals that grew up in Italian households would say that, that their mother's gravy was the best, and it had a unique flavor that you really hard to duplicate.
Hey, Cheech, when you retired from Westchester County, you know, in your career in law enforcement, you started a company and you became a security director for Emeril Lagasse. Tell me a little about that.
Well, when I retired from law enforcement, I retired as the chief of detectives for the district attorney squad in Westchester. Most guys that retired, they either went into insurance investigations for insurance companies, and my personality isn't like that. It's hard for me to sit still at a desk. So I bounced around from here to there. A guy by the name of Joe Constantino, who's a film director, basically specialized in documentary films, was doing a docudrama on the mob in the movies called Family Values, The Mob in the Movies. And he was looking for a guy like me that infiltrated organized crime, called me and asked me if I was interested in doing the law enforcement section of that particular docudrama, which I did. Really gave me a boost and an impetus into what I really wanted to focus on, and it was security. Ultimately, I hooked up with Chef Emeril. He was doing a food expo at the Javits Center in Manhattan. Never met the guy. Knew he was a celebrity chef. Worked with him that particular day. By the time I got home, I got a call from his.
Frank, what was it like cooking with him, with Emeril?
The chef took the fear out of cooking. I cooked most of my life, but being taught by the chef, I soared with sauces and learning different dishes and utilizing different spices. It was a 10-year journey, which I really enjoyed.
Well, that's pretty good, but let me ask you a question. Who makes a better meatball, you or him?
Well, you know, I have to say me, because it's my mom's recipe. I use a combination of beef, pork, and veal, garlic, bread soaked in milk, breadcrumbs, parsley, salt, pepper. My mom had, again, a unique way of making meatballs, which I adhere to. I loved the way she cooked, and she was a big inspiration in my life, and so was my father.
Hey, G.H., let me just change topics for a second. And we touched on this a little bit before about your time, you know, being undercover. I mean, I would definitely want to get back to, you know, the cooking segment and where we're at, but I'd like to get into, you know, I think one of the things the listeners are going to find absolutely fascinating is, you know, you spent the 6 years and you were deep cover. So you had a totally different identity. You come out of that. And what was it like when you come out of deep cover? You know, now you got to get back to normal. How do you get back to normal?
Well, you know what? When you're in the life of an undercover operative, you really have to adopt that life, you become that person to a large extent to carry the personality. When they pull the plug, it's almost like a woman giving birth. You know you're going to be born into the your real self, but you just don't you a hold of it, and then it happens, and then now you're not that Frankie Miranda anymore. You're Frank Santasola. For me, I thought I could handle it, but obviously, Sal, I couldn't speak 7 weeks. I don't know. It was so traumatic. I had to take time. I used to walk in a garden, look at flowers. I didn't want to be around people.
And you also had, you even caught a little bit, if I remember the stories right, I mean, you even caught a little bit of pushback, if we could say that, from the people in the department as well.
When I reported back for duty, after the assignment, I remember a secretary coming up to me and saying, "Frank, let me ask you a question." "Sure." "Didn't you feel like a rat? Don't you feel like a rat?" And I was like taken back. Like, rat? I'm not a rat. I'm a cop. I just didn't know where that this person was coming from. And I'll never forget that either. Because, you know what, it just shows you that people have different ideas of what the life is about, an undercover, an infiltrator. Who knows, maybe this person had friends that I did business with and didn't end up in too good a stead. But that I'll never forget either. That was some traumatic conversation I had.
You know, Frank, having come from law enforcement, I guess I have a real appreciation of what you guys went through when you were, you know, going deep cover, and having worked in the intelligence division and getting to meet some of them. I think, you know, what you guys do is just extra special. And I think the country, you know, as a whole, if they knew what really went on, really owes you a debt of gratitude for the stuff that you guys do and the sacrifices you make. But more importantly, let's turn this a little bit lighter, and let's talk about what was it like for you growing up Italian. I mean, you're a pretty fascinating character to begin with.
Sal, I loved it. You know, we grew up in a mixed neighborhood. There was Irish, Italian, Jewish. I grew up in Harrison, New York. Two-family house. My aunt and uncle and my cousins lived upstairs. We lived downstairs. My grandfather, Guidino, lived with us. He bounced for 4 weeks up in my uncle's house and then 4 weeks down in my house. And the guy, he was the patriarch of the family. I remember as a young kid, you know, being off summer vacations, he had a ritual. He'd get up early in the morning, and he'd always wear a fedora hat, white shirt, tie. He was maybe about 5'6", a little bit of a guy. He'd go out in, you know, summer, springtime. He'd light up that Bonobili cigar, look around, and then he'd have his morning constitutional up and down in front of the house. These are memories I'll never forget. He made homemade wine. I remember my cousin and myself, my brother Rich, he initially didn't keep the wine cellar padlocked, but after he caught us a number of times drinking his wine, he had a 55-gallon oak barrel with a spigot on the bottom, especially in the summer. I mean, it was hot. You know, we'd get down there, we'd take a cup of wine. And he caught us a number of times. You know, the guy spoke in broken English.
How old were you when you were heading the till?
I was probably like 7, 8 years old.
That sounds...
he barged in on us and he says, "Frank, what are you doing? You're just stealing the wine." And, you know, he used four-letter expletives. But, you know, these are the memories that this was me. This was what I remember. Look, Sal, I thought everybody was Italian. I had no clue.
But, you know, Frank, you said you grew up in a two-family house with a family around.
Yeah.
The world is different today. We seem to be really into a nuclear, broken-up family. But how, being Italian and being in that sort of environment, influence you?
Don, it's who you are. You know, like I said, I thought everybody was Italian. I thought everybody, you know, when you sat down to the family meal, you could feed the neighborhood. But it influenced me in my career, in my life. Look, they couldn't, the government could not ask somebody that was non-Italian to try to infiltrate organized crime.
No.
Look, I knew what they eat. I knew what they drink. I knew how to talk. I knew what not to say. I had half a brain. I was a moneymaker. I made money from them. So in that sense, you know, my Italian heritage, my background, was like opening the door to get in with these guys. And then I cooked them. Mm-hmm. I had one guy, he was a captain in this particular family that I was infiltrated, and he, you know, they put their money in restaurants. Just to hide some of their money. One of the chefs got sick one night. He was taking his girlfriend to the restaurant for dinner. The guy that I was a numbers runner at the time calls me up. And he said, "Hey Frankie, I heard you know how to cook a little bit. Mickey's chef is sick. Can you think you can fill in?" Well, you know what? I cooked him a 6-pound lobster stuffed with crab meat. I had broccoli rabe, a salad, some roasted potatoes. Well, the next day I'm taking numbers in this in my numbers joint, and I get the phone call from my crew chief, and he says, "Hey, Frank, you're getting promoted." I said, "What do you mean I'm getting promoted?" I said, "Wow, maybe I'll be a controller or something." "You know what?" He said, No. "Mickey wants you to be the chef at his restaurant." I said, "Really? Chef at your restaurant? I'm doing this stuff because I don't want to work hard." I tell him no disrespect, but no thank you.
Frank, you mentioned earlier how the police department, some of them said you were a rat. How do you feel about the fact that you had to infiltrate essentially an Italian-American mob?
Well, Don, you know what? It was my pleasure. Look, my father was an honest Italian-American. He was a bricklayer. I mean, I remember his hands in the winter were cracked from cold, the cement. He put two knuckleheads through college, me and my brother Rich. You know, I found out that a lot of people thought because you're Italian-American that you were part of the mob. That's so far from the truth. We have more senators, congressmen, doctors, lawyers of Italian American heritage, police officers. So for me, you know what? I wanted to do everything I could in my life to set the record straight, to honor my father, who was an Italian American, who made a life for his family, put food on the table. And the sacrifices he made. So for me, it was a direction that I had to take. It was something that I wanted to do to set the record straight for my family, at least, and Italian Americans at large.
Hey Frank, obviously your father is a prominent figure in your life, and rightfully so, but who was that one character when you look back? Was it Guarino? Was it that? Was
yeah.
he that character
yeah.
that was just comical?
It was my grandfather. You know, I mean, look, I was a kid that was always sort of disruptive. I think I'm dyslexic, so I don't know, maybe my mother took too much medicine when she was carrying me in during pregnancy. But I can't sit still, Stal. But Guarino, he didn't say much, but I constantly was messing up, and you know, he had a way about him, and he would set me up straight, and he'd look at me and he'd say, "Frank, I don't know what we're gonna do with you." He says, "You know, you're such a son of a gun. You know, you got to be a good boy."
Yeah.
And then, sometimes I would get out of line, and he had another expression. He'd look at me and he'd say, "Frank, don't you mess with me, please." These are the things, you know. And then, look, he was a very intelligent guy. My mom forced to play the piano as a young kid. My other aunt forced to play the violin. His other daughter, Anita, was an opera singer. My grandfather loved opera. So when we had the family dinners on Sunday, 20, 30 people sitting around this huge table, after dinner he'd say, "Okay, Inez, get the piano and Anita the violin." And they'd be singing Italian songs, whether they'd be playing and singing Neapolitan songs or opera would be going on constantly on Sundays. I thought I was in Italy, for God's sakes, you know.
Hey, Frank, if I remember right, you drove this guy, aside from Ready to Drink, you also had him fall down a well.
Oh, yeah.
You remember that story?
Well, listen, we... the whole family, my Uncle Louis was a caretaker for his estate in Huntington, Long Island. So he had permission, when the owner was away, he could bring his whole family up. So the whole family would go up to Huntington. It's a 144-acre estate. But it didn't have a running water. You had a well for water, and you had an outhouse. It was sort of rustic. It wasn't sort of rustic. It was rustic. And then in the front of the house, to the right of the house, there was a well with a cover on it. And I remember that one of my cousins, my brother, we took the cover off the well, and during the day we're throwing rocks in the water and blah, blah, blah. 6 o'clock, my Alina calls us in for dinner. Well, we forgot to put the cover in and over the well again, so for safety reasons. And then, you know, as I mentioned earlier, my grandfather took his early constitutional. Well, I can just envision this. You know, the guy's dressed up with white shirt, tie, fedora, hat. He go 6 o'clock in the morning. It must have been a little hazy out there because of the fog over the Long Island Sound. Lighten up that nobly. And he fell down the well. Now it's about 9 o'clock, and everybody wants to know what Pop is. But he's at the bottom of the well crying, "Aiutami," in Italian that means help, help me. "Aiutami." But, and you know, for screaming that for 3 hours, his voice was out of whisper. "Aiutami." Well, so everybody, "Where's Pop? Where's Pop? Look in the bedroom." Anyway, my aunt opens the front door to the house, and she hears faintly, "Aiutami." Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, she's running over to the well screaming, "Papa's in the well, Papa's in the well, get a rope, get this, get that." So the whole family, 20 or 30 people, looking at my grandfather at the bottom of the well. He busts his leg, and you know the thing he says, he looks up and he sees me, and he says, "Frank, you're no good son of a gun. Don't you look at me no more." They take him out in the ambulance, Sal. as he's driving away, as they're driving away down the road to the highway, to the hospital, I could hear him. I swear to God, "Frank, when I get home, you son of a gun, I'm going to kick you. Thank you so hard." This guy was a character.
Frank, we're going to interrupt you.
We're going to interrupt him?
We're going to interrupt him and talk about... He's such a great storyteller that we want to get into that.
Actually, I think we're going to go to a commercial first. We're going to... Frankie, we're going to hold off on that. We've got to slide a commercial in here. And then when we come back, when we come, it's going to be a short 30-second commercial. When we come back, we want to talk to you about the book that you put up with the maybe even touch on the screenplay that's been written about you.
All right.
All right. So don't go anywhere. Let's roll the commercial.
Are you a small business owner? Do you want to earn additional profits and improve your operations? One of the most favorite places where small businesses go for advice and counsel is the 2SBDigest.com. For 10 years, America's small businesses have turned to Small Business Digest for advice and guidance on generating additional sales, improving operations, finding financing, and improving their bottom line. Small Business Digest is available as an e-zine, through weekly newsletters, and on Blog Talk Radio. To learn more, go to the number 2SBDigest.com.
We're back with Frank Santasola, and we're sort of reminiscing about growing up Italian and things that that's happened in Frank's life and in his career. And in his storied career that he's had, what Frank has done in his retirement is to write not only a screenplay with a noted screenwriter, Dan DeLuca, who also another American-Italian, but Frank has written not only a screenplay but a book. Frankie, why don't you tell us the name of the book and a little bit about it?
Well, it's Miranda Rice, Honor and Justice. My street name was Frank Miranda. What the district attorney's office, they wanted to target a particular organized crime family. So they draw me in a neighborhood with a phony identification, phony name, phony Social Security, phony date of birth, and my street name was Frank Miranda. And people think it's like a playoff on the Miranda rights. It wasn't. There was a family in the crime families. Their last name was Miranda, so I adopted that name. But the book is about my psychological journey and emotional journey working in deep cover and then ultimately assigned to a federal informant whose family was Arabic, Jordanian specifically, who was importing heroin from the Middle East into New York for one of the organized crime families. The person that I was assigned to work with through the United States Attorney's Office claimed that he was innocent. You know, for me, all CIs, confidential informants, they say they're innocent, they didn't do it. Well, this guy was compelling, and subsequently he told me that he had his cousin, the same age. They were separated by a month. They looked like identical twins. Was the one that was the one of the couriers in this heroin trafficking conspiracy. That it was his cousin that was involved and not him. And the government arrested him, and it was a mistake. And ultimately, we had his conviction overturned. Actually the informant's mother persuaded the guy to come back from the Middle East from Oman and stand up and make a confession that it was him and not his cousin. But the book centers on. The initial part of it is my infiltration of this crime family, and then being assigned because the family I was involved with was the organized crime family that was involved in heroin trafficking, and then being assigned with this particular informant that was convicted after trial, was convicted for trafficking in heroin and sentenced to 10 years. His brother-in-law was sentenced to 25 to life. One of his sisters was sentenced to 20 years. So this is what I wanted to write about. I wanted to tell this story through the eyes of the guy that lived it. What it felt like, certain things that an undercover cop would do, would have to know. I was making narcotic buys. The guy, the informant, wanted to reduce his sentence, the 10-year sentence initially, and then, I mean, he had no hopes that we would ultimately have the guilty person come in.
The guy who you wind up, the main character in the book that you wind up going with, he wound up on the hook for, he was wrongly accused and is on the hook for prison time, and he's trying to work it off.
Right.
And the book really goes into, I guess, some of the, because I've had the pleasure of reading, and Don, you've read it as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very fascinating book. What I think Frank should talk to the audience about is what he found difficult about doing the undercover work, and some of the problems he ran into from the law enforcement side. Could you go into that, Frank?
Yeah, when you're infiltrating a particular group, you just can't fall out of the sky. As I said, I had a phony background, but I remember I had to find the weak link, and money is the weak link. I posed as a second story guy, a burglar, was selling swag, stolen jewelry. So I hooked up with this fellow that was in the crew of that I wanted to infiltrate, became friends with him. But I remember being tested for a year. I don't think I slept for a year, because every word you say, you wonder if it's gonna fly. So I at the end of the day, I'd be laying in my apartment wondering, did I say the right thing? Did I say the wrong thing? I couldn't wait for the next day, so I could see how they would accept me, if they would accept me. They, as I said, you just can't appear. They broke into my apartment to find out who I was. They had some contacts in the police department, check my motor vehicle information to see who I was, the car I was driving, who was registered to. So it was kind of.
I remember in part of the book and in reading it, I remember one of the more fascinating pieces of it was when you and your partner were out one particular time and you thought that you were being surveilled, and you really thought that it might have been law enforcement thinking that you were going bad and started to surveil you, and then all of a sudden you find yourself that it really wasn't law enforcement that was doing it.
No, well, this is it's sort of the end of the story. The informant I was working with was engaged to one of the wise guys who went away for 25 years, his daughter. And the wise guy in prison told some of his people, look, keep an eye on my daughter. So the bad guys were following me and the informant. It was sort of like a.
You eventually made a pretty strong case. What was your success? And people went to jail because of you, right, Frank? And you discussed it in your book.
Yeah, I think you had a lot of successes in the book. And I think what everybody really needs to understand is that, you know, Frank is just an incredibly humble person who's not going to he's not into self-promotion, and knowing Frank as well as I do, this is something that's probably a little difficult for him to kind of sit through and, you know, to kind of brag about the book. But I can tell you, having read it, and coming from law enforcement, you know, there are a lot of books that are out there these days that talk about law enforcement, and unfortunately, you know, they're just not the real thing. They're written by, not all of them, but some of them are books that are out there that are written by people that, you know, really didn't have the life experiences that a guy like Frank did. Mm-hmm. And when you read the book and you understand, it's really a good insight into law enforcement and to how cases are run and to the politics that you run into.
And more importantly, Sal, Frank is dyslexic, and he wrote the book. And I also had the pleasure of reading it. And having been a journalist as long as I have, I was extremely impressed by the quality of the writing. In fact, someone said, I sent it to my publisher. Hopefully he'll get it published. Yeah. But Frank...
That'd be great.
But Frank, one quick one. You also said that sometimes the cases you made somehow got picked up into politics. Am I correct in that?
Absolutely. Look, I made the politicians look good. They're interested in newspaper front page headlines. I'm not saying that they're not interested in prosecuting criminals. They are. But they want votes. And I found that if you can make a politician look good, then that's what it's about.
But what happens when you make them look bad?
Look, they get rid of you. You're not going to be put in a position to make them look bad. Absolutely. You're just monitored. For me, I mean, once I was in this crew, this organized crime crew for this family, I was on my own, which I really enjoyed. I didn't have anybody to answer with. I mean, every couple of weeks I'd meet a contact agent and I'd hand them a scribble report. Well, once in a while when I'd wear a wire, I really had to be really careful wearing a wire, a recording device, because they're always conscious of that. They're patting you, bumping into you. Look, they're looking for cops. They used to tell me, look, when I wake up in the morning, the first thing I look for is cops. That's their business. They want to stay safe. They want to stay out of jail. One guy told me, Frankie, you got to be careful in the circle you're traveling. And every other guy works for the FBI. I wanted to laugh, but correct.
Hey, Frank, yeah. One of the questions I get asked pretty often when people learn that I came from law enforcement is they always ask me, do you miss it? Do you miss being on the job?
Yes, I do. I do. It's it is the best thing that could have ever happened, because the kind of person I am, I fortunately or unfortunately, I like living on the edge and I like the excitement of it. It was challenging. Every day was a different day. You'd meet different challenges every single day.
Now, wait a second. From what I remember here, you almost became a school teacher and you were a cab driver before you were a cop, right?
That's exactly right.
Somehow I can't picture you driving a cab in Manhattan, pal.
Well, you know, it was unbelievable. Every time somebody got into the taxi, they'd say, well, what do you think the weather's going to be today? You know, after like 9 months of listening to that, I turned to the guy. You remember Uncle Webby? I think he was on Channel 5.
Yeah, Uncle Webby, yeah.
Yeah, I said, what do you think I am, the freaking weatherman? I said, I'm a cab driver. Just sit back there. And then they wanted to tell me, well, I think you should go. Now, pal, just sit there. Let me drive. I don't need any directions. I couldn't wait. Yeah, so my father said, look, Frank, I had just gotten married, and my wife was pregnant. I had no hospitalization. He said, look, you studied to be a teacher. But I couldn't be a teacher because I didn't think I'd be dedicated enough for the kids. Wouldn't do them justice. So why don't you take the police test?
And that's how you wind up becoming a cop.
Can I interject?
That's how because they had a good medical program there.
Frank, just to interject a quick point. When Frank, you did that, a majority of New York City cab drivers were Italian or Irish. Now there are almost none Italian and Irish. It's an interesting play on how things have changed.
Hey,
absolutely. Don, I remember getting a cab in Manhattan, and the cab driver's talking. I thought he was from India or Pakistan. I thought he was talking to me.
Frank, cut you short.
Frank, we're running out of time. We're going to have to cut this short. The only thing I want to talk about real quick is you wrote the book. You got it out there. As I understand, we're still looking for a publisher at this point, right?
Yeah, I'm looking for a literary agent or a publisher to get me to a publisher. This is a story I'd like to have told. It's an emotional journey through the eyes of an undercover cop that lived it. There's some excitement in it. There's behind-the-scenes law enforcement, how tactical operations are put together. It's about people. It's about personalities. I'd love the book to be published.
All right. With that, we're going to close out our show. But if anyone out there is listening and wants to be able to help in publishing or who is a literary agent and would like to contact Frank, they can contact us and we'll put you in touch with Frank. As we close out our show, I'd like to thank our special guest, Frank Santasola, for spending part of his day with us on this St. Patrick's Day. We hope you guys enjoyed listening to this and will share this program with your family and your friends. As was said earlier, you can follow us. Our address on Facebook is American Italian Radio. And on Twitter, you can follow us at #USAItalianRadio. For Don Mazzello and myself, thank you for listening, and we hope we have you guys back real soon.
Thank you for listening to American Italian Radio, the Air Channel. We hope you've enjoyed today's program, and we look forward to you joining us again next week. Please follow us on Facebook at American Italian Radio and on Twitter at #USAItalianRadio.